Welcome to Mormons on Mushrooms. In this podcast, we discuss alternative methods for healing from trauma and seeking a fulfilling life. We often discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. In addition, the opinions offered by our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the hosts of this podcast. If you'd like to support the program, please visit www.patreon.com/Mormons on Mushrooms. Thank you for listening and enjoy.
My mom's here. I was like, you're in the camera. She's like,
I thought that's who I saw in the background. I was going to give her a shout out, but then she up and skedaddled before I got a chance. Yeah.
Hello.
Wow. There he is.
In the flesh.
How's it going?
So good.
I'm in my bathroom.
Looking for the acoustics. I love it. Best acoustics, right?
Yeah. Do you use video of these, by the way?
No.
Okay.
Just the audio.
So my background doesn't matter.
It does not matter. My foreground doesn't matter. That's like the main reason we don't, because we still try to be pretty, I don't know, we're still a little anonymous as far as, you know, our identity. Shalice is not. Shalice is very open and out there with this stuff, but some of us are still a little bit nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's here. So I'm Doug.
Hi.
Shalice. And then we have Peter joining us. Hey, Peter.
Hello. Hey, everybody.
I'm Reed.
So, yeah, I was going to ask you, what do you prefer us to call you? Because after research, like after reading a bunch of shit about you and watching your TED Talks and watching, I'm like, I don't know what to call him. Doctor, Grandmaster, fucking magician, wizard.
Fun,
I don't know.
That's a fun one. Reed is great. Okay. I only use the doctor title when I have to.
Carries a little bit of... a little bit of extra sauce if you use the doctor title, right?
Yeah, and it's not even that. Like if a parent needs it for their, you know, when they're scared and want some trust in someone taking care of their kid or something like that, I guess. But it's a pet peeve of mine when people use it to like leave their car at the valet at a hotel or something.
Calling in for reservations. Yeah, this is Dr. Robinson. Table for four. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking some time with us today. We'll do a quick intro here and all that kind of stuff, but we usually do these pretty casually.
Sweet.
Okay. And normally this is when Peter or Shalice would say something because everyone's tired of maybe hearing my voice at this point, but We're just a quick intro. We're joined today by Dr. Reed Robison. I don't know how to introduce you beyond that because I was just telling Shalice before you hopped on. I watched your TED talk about genome sequencing, and I was like, holy shit! I don't even know if I can be in the same conversation with this dude. Like, it was blowing my mind.
I started to read the list of the stuff he's involved in, and like, I'm not entirely convinced you haven't invented like cheese or something, and we just don't know about it. Like, the list is ridiculous.
That'd be cool. And it's impressive if you made it through that TED talk. I've got to admit that it does get a little bit technical, and if not boring at some points.
I said it to my wife and was like, "You got to watch this. This is blowing my mind." So
given the you know, the credentials list that shows up from different places where you're profiled, how would you prefer to introduce yourself kind of in this context?
Yeah, Reed is just fine. Do you mean beyond that, like what I do for a living?
Yeah, who are you? Tell us about yourself.
So, professionally, I guess I'm a psychiatrist. Outside of work settings, I'm a dad, a son, a sibling, all those sorts of things, a yogi, a meditation enthusiast, I guess. I'm one of those people who enjoys talking about psychedelics, like all of you, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah. I'm a mental health proponent.
So maybe because we do want to talk about your work with ketamine and MDMA, we also want to just talk about personal, like your experience with psychedelics and where they've led you from where to here kind of thing. But maybe as far as kind of getting the ball rolling, can you just tell us a little bit about where'd you come from? Like what was your life like growing up and what were your expectations for yourself and then what happened? And we're going to ask it then what happened a lot of times today, I think.
Cool. I like it. So yeah, I'd love to share whatever comes to mind, starting at the beginning, perhaps. I was born in Chicago while my parents were in grad school. My dad had gone to BYU. My parents met at BYU. My mother converted to the church before as a college student, and then met my dad there. They had my sister, who's a year older, moved to Chicago, had me in grad school. And then I actually did a year of preschool in Utah before we moved as a family to Canada, where I grew up, kindergarten through high school near Toronto. And so I grew up in a very active Mormon family. And as a conscientious young lad with a lot of budding young people pleasing traits and really taking on the weight of my world, internalizing lots of guilt as I grew up, trying to do what was right. And then at kind of a ripe age of 17, I hopped on a plane and came out to BYU because my sister went there, my parents went there. Every sibling after me, all five of us went there. My dad, I say helped, but essentially wrote my college essays. I don't know if I should admit that. And so I flew the coop and came to the bustling city of Provo and, you know, started my journey away from home here.
Did you have a sense of whether that was really your only viable option at the time? Was it something you wanted to do or something you felt like you more had to do?
You know, I was somewhat along for the ride. It's funny to look back at because, you know, as I grew up, you know, I consider myself a bit of a late bloomer in terms of waking up and having, you know, preferences that were my own and speaking my own truth and things like that. And so I didn't question it one bit. I just went to the college that my parents wanted me to. Do I regret it? No, it was a great experience, but I'm not one for regrets in general, just with what I do for a living. And I don't think I was actively engaged in a like conscious deliberation in my mind back then.
So you graduated from BYU. I don't know what your undergrad was.
It was in neuroscience. I was the first batch of students to do that major. I had gone on a mission to France. So after 1 year of college, went out to France. That was fascinating to get immersed in a Catholic culture, knocking on doors with these other random dudes who had no idea what they were doing either. And all these rules we were supposed to follow. But I was pretty gung-ho, a little bit of a rebel edge, but with what I felt like was a positive cause. Like I'd break the rules to get the baptisms, like in a way that felt good to me. Like we baptized some lady at midnight, for example, in a pool in her backyard, and then, you know, got in trouble for a minute, but also kind of high-fived at the same time. You know what I mean? So I did some growing up out there and just fell in love with the culture too. came back, finished my neuroscience degree. I changed majors 100 times, but I kind of knew I was headed to medicine. And I already had this fascination with the human brain and especially behavior. And so from there, I just went right into med school at the University of Utah.
So neuroscience, I'm particularly interested in, and I feel like this is going to be a trend through a lot of the questions that I have in the epistemology or the sort of the language and culture of the church, where so much is based on spiritual practice. Did you ever find conflicts or things that you couldn't reconcile with studying neurobiology or physiology of the brain in terms of explaining why people do things the way they do versus what maybe the church taught?
Oh yeah, there was a lot of that from the get-go. I was in the era, I went to BYU starting in like 94. And this was when evolution was still a bit of a taboo topic or causing a divide within my biology 100 class, that I was just blown away, because I came from a pretty liberal culture or country, living far away from Utah, but in a very strict religious home. But to see this debate unfold of like, evolution isn't real, and a professor pushing buttons and students saying, you can't say that. And I was like, wow, I just was enamored with how it all unfolded, and found lots of conflicts, but kind of gravitated more and more to the scientific side. I ended up, I think, throwing some of my faith baby out with the bathwater a bit, of like embracing science and doubting the unseen.
So what part of your life was that when you started transitioning into more of a scientific point of view?
Yeah, that was, it was a slow process, but through college. And then when I went to med school, the University of Utah, I remember my parents even commented on like how liberal that place is, or how people come from all sorts of places across the country, with all sorts of political views and religious, or even, heaven forbid, like atheist beliefs. And so I, you know, that was really influential for me during my residency training after med school. So when I really kind of started to get brave about my questioning, you know, vocalize it, share it, confide in others, and then even start to talk about it at home.
Is there fallout for that?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there was lots of fallout. There was lots of, what do they say in the scriptures? Is it gnashing of teeth and wailing, shedding of tears, something like that. But I remember the first time I went openly to a rated R movie, like, I had watched some. I would do some in secret, but that would cause a lot of guilt, like watch it on a plane or when traveling for work. But, you know, one day I just, I went with my brothers too, but it was my parents and my wife at the time were sitting there, and I'm like, I'm going to this radar movie. And she's a beautiful soul, by the way. We're great co-parents, nothing but respect and love. She shed a lot of tears when I shared that I was going against that rule. Same thing with like a glass of wine. And then when I opened up about not believing in like the Mormon faith as it's outlined or as it was dished out to me, when I opened up to my co-parent, my ex-wife, I thought it was an atomic bomb and instantly the end. But you know, she took it beautifully well, but still in the end, we ended up going our separate ways. You know, it's just what I think needed to happen, but that's one of the other fallouts from it, getting divorced.
Yeah. I'm curious about, I remember the first rated R movie. I felt like I was doing the worst thing I could possibly do. The movie was Stand By Me. I don't know if y'all have seen it's like the Stephen King short story. Yeah. There's a scene where the boys, I mean, children, talk about Annette from the Mickey Mouse Club and how big her boobs are getting. And I have a solid memory of watching that movie. Didn't even go to the movie theater, just rented it with a couple of my buddies and we watched an R-rated movie. And I remember feeling like I would probably be going to the outer darkness because here I am at an R-rated movie, a place that you're not supposed to be in the first place. And now these guys are talking about a girl's boobs. And I was like, dude, this is it for me. I don't know if God's going to be able to forgive me on this one. So I'm curious if you remember your first R-rated movie.
Yeah. So not the first one I ever watched and kind of internally metabolized the guilt of or stored guilt away somewhere. But that one that I was talking about when I openly said I'm going to a rated R movie in front of my wife and parents, that was Shutter Island.
Dude.
And it was a good one.
It is good.
Yeah. Man. And it had a psychiatric theme and being a psychiatrist, I was like, come on, it's for work.
And that movie's a mind fuck too. Like, yeah. Shutter Island's a good first R-rated movie to go to. I was reeling after seeing that one.
Yeah. It was a good one.
I have more stories to tell unless you guys have questions. I like that you were talking about being kind of like the ends justify the means on your mission, you know, like yeah. I'll break the rules, but it's for the greater good. It's for baptisms and bringing people to Christ. Speaking of being a late bloomer, as a missionary, I blossomed because I was like, these are rules I can get behind and letter of the law type of guy. And nothing can ever shake my faith in the Mormon church. And then like you're describing, I then lost my faith and became a hardcore atheist and nothing could shake my faith in my atheism. And then psychedelics came along and I was like, oh, I don't know. Maybe I'm not so atheist, you know? So I'm curious as to what was that slow leash that led you down to hell?
And hell, define hell for me.
Leaving the Mormon church.
So, you know, it was as I was kind of immersed in mental health work, like as a psychiatrist, and just getting to know deeply personally people from different belief systems and people I could trust and confide in and open up. It felt safe in that way. Then I started to really struggle with some of the, you know, inconsistencies in my values and what was, I think the church was doing at the time towards say LGBTQ individuals and not supporting them. And I was seeing the mental health consequences.
What year are we around here? Shutter Island is like 20. 10.
So I finished my training in 2009. I finished residency med school in 2005. So I came out as this kind of board certified psychiatrist, 2009, stayed at the University of Utah for a couple of years working there. But that one was just not okay. And didn't sit well with me because, you know, people were suffering so much that they didn't want to be alive. You know, I lost patience. So I was like, it's not okay. And then even like, you know, pornography addiction, compulsive viewing of things like that, the guilt that my clients took on because of that was, you know, that was a burden I felt like they didn't need to carry. Like it, you know, it's hard enough being human, right?
So at this point, are you like, is the connection being made to say, well, these people happen to be members of the church and they're having this problem, or was the connection starting to be made that maybe there is a cause and effect relationship starting to happen?
Yeah. So everyone struggles. And, you know, what we need in those times is a support of other, to be seen, to be held, to feel like, you know, we're not alone in it. And that's what I think was missing. I love like the fact that in religion, people come together as a community and worship. Like that's, you know, looking at it, that's a beautiful thing. I love a good neighborhood, bringing each other cookies or checking in on each other in whatever way. Yeah. The guilt and shame that that the people I worked with would take on from like the culture not being accepting, understanding of some struggles, whether it be addiction, whether it be a different way they want to live their life, their sexual orientation, whatever it may be. That was where I became really concerned and just couldn't stay in that and support that. Mind you, since then, I do feel like, you know, the world's changed and is changing. We're all kind of waking up at different rates and in different ways. But the new generation, you know, in or outside of the church, is much more understanding to that kind of thing, all those things.
You mentioned you kind of threw your faith baby out with the bathwater. I'm curious if you've tried to reclaim some of that or a portion of that.
Yeah, you know, it's always been there, but I kind of I don't know. I was a highly, deeply spiritual kid and teenager in some ways, and missionary especially. Like I was all in, like praying for real, or really going deep in whatever I could. During this kind of faith transition time over the years, I did kind of numb that out, that spiritual part of me. And then it was a process reclaiming it. But I remember a dramatic kind of stepping stone in that journey was my first ever ayahuasca experience. When I went down to the jungle, I was going to work at an ayahuasca retreat as a medical director, a psychedelic therapist. And as a prerequisite, I needed to experience the medicine. You know, I wanted to anyway. It was time, but it was I was going there seeking tools for my patients. Like I was working with eating disorders, and not where some of them, like anorexia, doesn't even have any FDA-approved medication treatment options. I was searching for new ways of helping people fight that. Maybe a little like deepening of my spirituality, a wee bit of increased awareness, something like that. But I wasn't really looking for God or spirituality. And you know, finding a medicine that could be helpful therapeutically was kind of the easy part. I found that faith baby I'd thrown out. You know, I found God, essentially. I mean, or I'd say God found me, like lost, wounded, more like this baby in a basket drifting down a river, dazed, confused, and kind of showed me another side of this coin, like Steve Jobs said. And I just came out of that first experience, those few ceremonies, with this kind of embodied knowing of the truth of who you are doesn't need an answer. You know, you don't need to be able to explain. It doesn't need to make sense. Cause I was, you know, I was a scientifically minded individual just trying to explain it all and not really get caught up in the things I couldn't see or explain with a mathematical equation. But all of a sudden, then I was like reconnected to these deep lost parts of myself, like, and nature and the rhythms of the day, and seeing how drastically we get disconnected from like life and being alive, and how we were paying the price of it just by constricting our lives from, you know, all these things, conditioning anxieties and, you know, modern vices and, you know, technologies, and kind of losing our souls in the process.
I think the listenership of the podcast, the active members of the community, more often than not, are coming to these first experiences from places of wanting either curiosity or wanting to do their work or looking for something to help them with relief. And there's often an expectation management issue that people run into where you try to prepare and you try to set intentions, but how can you get away from expectations? And what I'm hearing from you is like, this is a really different angle. Like, did you find that you were going in with different expectations because you're doing it, trying to do it on behalf of other people or to prepare for other people?
You know, it's kind of funny looking back at my first ever ayahuasca experience. The organizers and my kind of collaborators in this whole retreat were saying, okay, leave yourself some time and space when you land to adjust. You know, you probably want to be rested. I got off the plane. I'm like, I got this. Got off the plane. And within 2 hours was sitting in a maloka on a mat waiting for some mystery shaman to walk in. But something that one of my friends and mentors out there gave me as a suggested intention was really helpful. It was, you know, when in doubt, and even if you have some preconceived notions of intentions for this experience, you may want to consider surrender. Hmm. And so I just embraced that. And it's kind of funny. So I drank the medicine, you know, the sun setting, there's a small half a dozen of us sitting in this open air, like space, river under us, jungle everywhere around us. And I drink this medicine. We sit there in silence and meditation for about 45 minutes until it kicks in. And some people start throwing up. It's kind of funny. The shaman starts chanting, singing. A bunch of people are throwing up. I'm like, oh, here it goes. You know, let the fun begin. And then for me, I just started shedding tears. And that went on a long time. Like, and it was a calm, peaceful, like cathartic release. And I had no idea where they came from.
Wow. Was sitting for that first ayahuasca ceremony, was that your first introduction into psychedelics or any of these plant medicines that we're talking about?
No, I was pretty well versed in psychedelics by then. The other ones, even DMT, you know, in its more compressed, condensed forms, even, you know, ceremonially as well. But I'd had experiences with most of the other psychedelics by then.
Wow.
So did the adventure work? Like, you went there seeking some alternative for your patients. Like, this is the starting point of a pivot in your journey. Did you actually find that?
Yeah, I did. It was definitely a pivotal moment for me in my career, where out there, you know, I found this aliveness, you know, that I realized that the answers I was seeking, like scientifically, I shouldn't be looking for the meaning of life as much as the experience of being alive. And that unfolded it through this week of like, I had this new bounce in my step, this new connection to earth and people. Like, I would look into people's eyes and see something deeper. Like, it felt like soul land in a way. And I would, I would get in there with people in their stories like I'd never been able to before, kind of meet them where they were at, shed tears with them plenty that week. And as they went through their medicine journeys, healing journeys, like, we had, you know, a couple dozen people come to this retreat over a week or so after I had gone out for my own experiences. But then, so then I came back. I remember being on the boat, coming back from the jungle towards my flight home, talking to someone saying, I was working with ketamine for already like 10 years by then, saying, never again am I going to even give ketamine without like a sacred container, without ceremony, without intention. And yeah, it definitely influenced my work forward big time.
Well, Ketamine, so maybe we can back up a little bit. So how did you go from, you're coming out as a board certified psychiatrist. What can we fill in the blank? Like when, where did psychedelics show up? How did that happen?
Yeah, so I finished my training, came out as a faculty member at a university doing research, trying to find better psychiatric treatments, like looking for new ways of approaching mental health challenges, because I was not too satisfied with the status quo in that regard, like the response rates of Prozac. And not only that, but how these things tend to just address symptoms, or they might numb in the process some of our approaches rather than getting to the underlying causes. So I was doing clinical trials over and over, and then I encountered ketamine. The research was coming out by some smart folks who had discovered that it has rapid antidepressant properties. So I got my first grant to study it in 2011 and led the Utah site for this big ketamine study by a drug company that eventually brought a ketamine type nasal spray to market, Janssen. And through that study, I got to sit with a lot of people who had depression, but we gave IV ketamine, and I would ask them these structured questions, but just hear them talk about their experience during, I was like, just fascinated by the psychedelic type experience of that medicine, even though the study was using it just as a medicine and we were measuring these psychedelic side effects. So I started giving it at, I set up a ketamine practice back in 2011 at Intermountain Medical Center, like the biggest hospital in Utah. In the cancer center, we'd have a chair or two to do ketamine for people with severe depression. And at first I'd use nurses in the cancer center to help sit with people. Like I'd go run and see a consult or come back, but clients would often start to cry or sing or have this cathartic release of some things they were holding on to. And people in this infusion center were not used to that. So we had to eventually insert our own nurse and tech to be able to continue this. Because if someone's talking about like existential crisis or, even some thoughts of hopelessness or not wanting to be alive, but, you know, they were pretty spooked because they weren't used to that. But that's when I started working with ketamine. And as the years progressed, I saw the potential in the psychedelic experience and was also starting to have my own, starting with ketamine, but other psychedelic medicines. And so I started working with MDMA and psilocybin and other compounds therapeutically.
Now the timeline here, this is either around the same time or slightly before, like the Johns Hopkins end of life cancer treatment trials with psilocybin, right?
Yeah, this is all within the last few years. So my first psychedelic experiences were, might have been 10 years ago, but working with other compounds, like I helped MAPS design their eating disorder study with MDMA for anorexia and binge eating disorder. And then that's progressed to like that ayahuasca experience and more recently working on some psilocybin protocols.
So I'm not actually very familiar with ketamine, which tells me some other people listening might not be either. Could you just explain a little bit about what it is and how it works?
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting medicine in that it was designed decades ago as an anesthetic and happens to be a really convenient medicine for anesthesia, for different procedures. In fact, the first time I ever gave it was in primary children's ER during my training, when we'd give it to kids to help them hold still before they got sutures or had a fracture set. But ketamine is a a medicine used in anesthesia, sometimes pain, and now mental health that happens to have a rapid antidepressant response in most people, like within minutes or hours compared to weeks in, say, 70% of people. It lasts about an hour when you take it. It could be an IV, a shot, sublingual, a nasal spray. Lasts maybe an hour or so and brings about a psychedelic experience that is different. I mean, every medicine has its own unique signature, but you know, this is a chemical that takes you outside of yourself, has some calming, heart opening properties, ego dissolving as the doses get higher, but it's a dissociative anesthetic. So it's got this unique kind of dreamlike state, if not out of body experience, that it brings people. And it doesn't, in my opinion, come with some of the as much of the natural insight as the classic psychedelics do, say like psilocybin, ayahuasca. But I'm also a firm believer that we can insert a lot of that with the container, with the preparation, the integration work.
Yeah. Peter, Shalice, you've not done ketamine?
No.
I haven't, no.
Yeah. So for me, like if you're like looking at like, you know, psilocybin and DMT and ayahuasca and LSD and MDMA, like for me, ketamine, I think that you said it perfectly, Reed. I didn't get a bunch of like things that I wanted to sit with or minor personal revelations. I just felt this sense of, gosh, dreamlike state, like euphoric dreamlike state of just being very, very confident and content with my existence and it's my standing with the people around me and my standing in the world. I didn't care about that kind of stuff. I just cared that like, oh, I exist. And isn't this all right? Isn't life just cool and fun and beautiful? That's been my experience with it.
I like that description because it, like I mentioned, it is ego dissolving, but also if you look at it from a brainwave standpoint or a neurochemical standpoint, it slows down consciousness and gives you a timeout. And as the dose gets higher, consciousness slows down more and more, where you could even like pause consciousness in a sense by that's where it gets into anesthesia territory. You're not going to pull as much back if you give someone like 10 times the dose that we give in mental health becomes kind of anesthesia doses. It's a very different medicine at the low doses where you can kind of go into that place, lucid dreamlike place, and maybe experience your like ego structures falling apart, but then the sense of peace and oneness, and then come back in a hurry. Like all of a sudden you're back in regular day-to-day life, but you've had this experience.
Love that you mentioned the integration angle. We talk about that a lot. Personally, that's a passion of mine, the importance of integration. One of the criticisms I've heard about ketamine clinics and the proliferation of ketamine clinics is that there are some that operate almost like an assembly line. You come in, you sit in this, you know, clinical setting, you get your infusion and they send you home and that's the end of it. And I'm curious your take on the idea of take pill, get better. Like I take an Advil for a headache, but that's not necessarily the mechanism of action of a psychedelic. How does ketamine maybe fit into that space?
Yeah. Just like anything, you could use it for good or evil. No, I'm not one to judge. Like the ketamine clinic boom is in part, it's fueled by people's desire for new approaches. And what I get concerned about is the lack of really good mental health support around that, because sometimes, well, quite often healing can be disruptive and you're very likely going to shake some things up and you'll need a good container and safety net to deal with that. And so that's what I think, if you're going into one of these, say, anesthesia run ketamine clinics or infusion centers without mental health presence, then you should have your mental health support and treatment team in place going into that.
So, by the way, let's pause for a second. Reed and Peter, I got to tell you, before the two of you hopped on, Shalice showed me, she got a whole page of notes and bullet points. So I'm just waiting for her to drop that.
I'm just sitting back.
You're just sitting back, like locked and loaded, ready to go, huh?
Well, Reed, there's so many things that you've accomplished, and we can talk about any one of those things, like 10 of these on my list for an hour apiece. So I don't even know where to go from here. I mean, I read that you work with Novamind. Can you maybe explain a little bit about what that is and what you're excited about with that?
Yeah, I'd love to. So a few years ago, I left my post as working at an eating disorder treatment facility because I felt called to do something a little bit, unexpected, and start a clinic, start a ketamine-assisted psychotherapy clinic, a mental health clinic with psychedelic medicine in it, starting with ketamine. And so I did that. I found this serendipitously, found this business partner who needed the skills I brought to the table. I wasn't going to do it without what she brought to the equation. And so we opened one clinic in Utah County. And it was all growing pretty fast pre-pandemic, but mental health was starting to be more and more embraced and accepted. It was like, we have a long way to go in that stigma, but growing up, you can talk about going to therapy or anything like that. But now the newer generation seems to be embracing it. Therapy is even becoming cool in some ways for some people, which is awesome. But so the clinic grew, we expanded it to 4 at a MAPS psychedelic science conference a couple of years ago. I met some now colleagues and friends from a company called Novamind. They were then a venture fund focused on psychedelics and had these other skills that they brought to the equation, this shared vision, but experience and resources, navigating the capital markets and scaling businesses. And so we just hit this like, whoa, 4 clinics, what are we going to do? how do we manage this? Where do we go next? And so we joined in. They acquired our clinics, and we had a research site as well doing clinical trials. And we joined them, and I signed on as their chief medical officer and board member. And they took that company public, or we did, in January of this year. And now we're approaching 8 clinics in Utah, about to announce one out of state. And they're mental health clinics. And we're focused on building the infrastructure for this new era of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, of mental health, where we're going for the cure instead of band-aid approaches to treating symptoms, like where we're going to embrace these tools like ketamine, like psilocybin, like MDMA, where you'll come in and get it once or twice or 3 times with a bunch of therapy to really go deep and get to the underlying stuff on a healing journey. So that's what we're up to.
That's amazing. It's just so awesome that you're diving into that. And I feel like there's an explosion among medical communities within psychedelics. And I wonder, though, how do you get around the legalities of all of this with these substances?
Patience. No, I'm waiting. It's been 2-3 months now since I've had a couple Schedule 1 applications for 2 of our locations into the DEA. I had to go through Utah first and just got their approval to have psilocybin and give it in for depression and other conditions. But now it's going through the DEA process. And that's just an example of the slow, but I feel important path of figuring this out so we can give it to people in broad daylight with all the scientific evidence and they need to feel confident and comfortable in going down that rabbit hole. But ketamine is legal. It's I work above board using whatever we can legally. And when we haven't been able to access it here, like I'd go seek it out in the jungle. But really, we're focused on what we can do here in the U.S., here in our clinics.
That's so awesome. To that therapy thing, we talk pretty openly about therapy on the podcast a lot. I'm a person who thinks that every single person should regularly see a therapist. I think that it's good to have that sounding board. It's good to have someone who's trained to help you deal with some of that shadow work and some of that trauma that you're dealing with that you just can't voice to maybe friends and family, you know. But I'm curious as to your opinion about that, because there really is, like, it used to be so taboo. The idea of seeing a therapist was like, oh, you're two steps away from being a nut, you know. And you know, if you look at the two and a half, three generations, we're talking about like World War II, Korea, the Vietnam War. These are the people. I mean, they desperately need someone to help recalibrate their mental health. And yet that seems to be a generation that was so opposed to the concept of therapy. Like you said, it's just now kind of emerging as like, you know, therapy is cool as a t-shirt I've seen before. People are like therapists are dancing on Instagram everywhere you look and that kind of thing. And therapy is becoming this more socially acceptable, non-taboo thing, which gives me hope for the work you're doing, some of these other psychedelics that we like to talk about that I think are just very valuable. In your experience, where does that taboo come from? Like what's the big deal?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The dancing therapist on Instagram you may be thinking of is actually the one who made the therapy is cool t-shirt.
There's I'm talking about Tiffany Rowe. Like,
same badass therapist around here, Tiffany Rowe. She's a good friend, and you know, kudos to what she's done to bring this conversation into you know, the modern day in a really good way. But where it comes from, it's showed up in different ways through the ages. But looking back at our parents and their parents, at the time of World War II, you know, when so many people are getting drafted, whisked away to fight these battles, you could not feel your feelings in to their full expression in the trenches of war, right? Like you were taught to numb that out. And then the families at home were also supposed to just grin and bear it. But then you got these soldiers coming home where they've had to disconnect for survival from their feelings. And that created a whole generation that, you know, in our parents and grandparents, where emotions were not welcome, you know, fall off your bike, cry, oh, don't cry. Here's an ice cream. Let's hit it with a tiny bit of dopamine, get rid of that, distract from it. And let's squash that, interrupt it, cut it out. And so I think we got our parents, grandparents, they got really good at emotional interruption, emotional suppression. And then you know, we're like pressure cookers though. That can only stay bottled up so long. Eventually it's going to blow one way or another. And it's spilling out. It has been, and now we're realizing that you've got to feel it to really heal. You've got to we've got to bring these pesky little emotion things back, because they have so much wisdom guiding us in how to live our lives.
Man. Yeah, that's interesting. That's exactly. I mean, so my experience, you know, my grandpa, like a decorated World War II hero, you know, but it's like this thing of like, grandpa is this man's man. He's a farmer and he's a World War II hero and he's tough as nails. And it's like, yeah, but I've never had much of a conversation with my grandpa. He retreats to the basement with a bottle of tequila anytime we're over, you know. It's like we've been seeking some kind of therapeutic release. And for 60 years, it's grab the bottle of tequila and head to the basement type of thing.
Yeah.
That wasn't a question. I'm just saying. Yeah.
No, it's true. And, but now, therapy is becoming cool, right? It should have been that way long ago, of course, but, you know, why was it so taboo to go see a therapist or a psychiatrist? You know, it should be like going to take care of any condition, right? It should be as normal as going to your family doc when you have the flu. But like we've been talking about, the conversation is shifting and we're talking more about our mental health. The messaging is getting less strong that asking for help is weak, or that, you know, feelings are weakness. And so we're turning back to those things, and, you know, working on mental health is now more and more being seen as a sign of strength, not weakness. So showing up for ourselves so we can show up for others.
There's pretty clear evidence that indicates things like poverty are both contributing factors to mental health issues and results of. The people that are in those situations are generally not the ones that are likely to have the resources to be able to access these kind of services. How do you personally, or how does Novamind rectify the people that are most likely to benefit this from are often the least likely to be able to access it?
Yeah, no, it's a big issue. And I'm 100% in agreement that we need to address that proactively, all hands on deck from the get-go. That accessibility piece is huge. And diversity, you know, equitable access, inclusivity. So, and it's always been a thing for me. Like when I was at the University of Utah, I started a free clinic because I was a bit bothered by the fact that I couldn't give away free care if someone couldn't afford it. It just, like, I didn't have control over that. So I teamed up with some colleagues and friends, got some space donated, named a clinic after my grandmother who passed away from addiction, but was a beautiful soul and, you know, who fought her own mental health battles, but really with dignity and a lot of traits I admire. And so fast forward till now, we've from the get-go taken the approach of bringing our ketamine therapy costs down to, I'm convinced, I've yet to find someone who offers it more affordably in the country. So, and we do this, you know, in some creative ways of having a, you know, a shared room or group format sometimes, or individual curtain bays with where we'll keep our voice down in the therapy pieces before and after, but really making it accessible. And then when a nasal spray form of ketamine, S-ketamine, Spravato, came out on the market, no one really was giving it because there weren't the billing codes. Insurance companies didn't know what the heck to do with this in-office FDA-approved medicine for depression. So we just said, okay, we're all in. We're giving this. We've given it to probably 3,500 doses in Utah since it came out in 2019. And we have leveraged so much patient assistance, like hundreds of thousands of dollars of patient assistance, to where most people have just paid a $5 copay to get that medicine in office, not a take home daily. Because the company has a new medicine, it's expensive, and they donate up to like $8,000 a year per patient for copays. So we milk that for all it's worth for our people to be able to access. But there's more work to do. We're starting a nonprofit focused on accessibility called Psychedelic Institute. It exists. We're waiting for the IRS to grant us the 501c3 status, but yeah, we're going to launch with our first project is going to be an MDMA assisted psychotherapy study for gender minority related trauma.
Wow.
Wow. Can you expand on that? That's a lot.
You know, people, this need for access to care and the inequality in how marginalized populations can access mental health care is a problem. And mental health struggles especially show up when individuals are marginalized or on the outskirts, or so in, say, gender minority individuals, for example, transgendered or anyone identifying differently than their kind of gender of record at birth, there are high rates of depression, suicidality in that population. And a lot of it is trauma related. Trauma is at the root of many things. And so we're designing a study to help address that in a group format for both the affordability, but the healing power of the group to know you're not alone in it.
Wow.
Wow. And is that your, I guess, yours or Novamind's solo effort? Is that in concert with MAPS?
So that's in collaboration with a psychiatrist out of Portland who actually grew up in Utah, who has done some great work with MAPS and with other psychedelic medicines. For all sorts of populations in need of healing efforts. And so we're proposing it to MAPS, yes, going through that process. But we've all kind of worked with MAPS on other projects, and we've connected with Encircle House around it too. It's not out there in the public yet. So I'm just giving a little teaser because the timeline's to be determined, but that's just one effort. Novamind's about building clinics and research sites to enable this new era of psychedelic medicine, you know, open up access to psychedelic therapies, starting with ketamine clinically and all the mental health we can provide, but then access to the other medicines through studies. So we're working on bringing psilocybin into Utah, which our goal is to dose people before the year's over, for sure, for a depression study, but proposing all sorts of other protocols and focus areas.
So you talked about 3,500 doses given. What kind of results are you seeing from the ketamine ceremonies?
So that number was around the Spravato. So all of those are insurance covered.
Okay.
But we've given many more doses of ketamine plus therapy in the regular ketamine that isn't covered by insurance. But the results are pretty consistent with what people saw 10 plus years ago in the early depression studies of 70% of people get dramatically better very quickly, but it does not last. So this is a window of opportunity to do some therapeutic work, to get plugged in with other supports and treatments. And, you know, some people will continue on a maintenance ketamine, which is fine. And it's still not a daily medicine and, you know, has some, and it's quite a safe and well-tolerated medicine for the most part. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to when we can give these other medicines like psilocybin plus therapy for depression, end-of-life anxiety, or MDMA plus psychotherapy for PTSD. Like those most recent studies that came out using MDMA for PTSD were consistent with the other studies and showed that like 70% of people no longer even meet criteria for PTSD 6 months later, 12 months later, after three doses of medicine plus therapy.
Wow. You kind of just answered my question. I was going to ask you from your professional standpoint and perspective, which medicines you have found to work best for certain conditions.
Yeah. It's still to be determined for all the other conditions, right? Hence the need for more studies. But definitely for trauma, MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. For depression, we have ketamine, psilocybin coming down the pipeline and will be a prescribable option. We're actually working on some compassionate use efforts too, trying to open up access to psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy for certain conditions outside of studies too. There's a pathway for that, but it's a, you know, it requires patience and persistence. And we're starting with end of life anxiety or serious medical condition related distress for that effort.
The West is kind of discovering or rediscovering, you know, the psychedelic renaissance is the term that comes up a lot, but so much of it is rediscovering something that was always there. And indigenous cultures in particular, like say the ayahuasca ceremony, these are steeped in ceremony, in ritual. They take a lot of time, and it's not just here's your medicine. It's the whole container, the whole ceremony, the whole process through it. How important have you found that ceremony aspect or the ritual aspect to be in working with patients in a more clinical setting?
You know, it's huge. And we see it in the other medicines too, including ketamine. We prepare so much for an ayahuasca experience because the shamans tell you to. You got to stop eating this and that and get off these medicines. And that, you know, whether it was absolutely required or not for your medical safety during, there's a psycho-spiritual preparation by making something sacred or special that is really powerful. And you can do that with other medicines too, and doing anything with intention. And there's so much power in just the ceremony and the ritual by itself of getting us outside of the daily hustle and bustle and, you know, connecting to something bigger than ourselves in that kind of way, and doing it with intention, even if it's hard, is incredible. I'm with you there. A big fan of the ceremony component.
Do you find that patients are, I don't know, maybe resistant to that because we're in this culture of give me my pill, give me my shot, it'll fix what's wrong, get it done faster, get it done more efficiently, particularly when like IPO money starts showing up and they want a return on their investment.
Yeah. And that is deeply ingrained. We are trained to turn for the quick fix. Understandably, if there's a quicker fix, you reach for it. But I think that dissatisfaction with our approach to mental health and wellness has kind of bubbled up to the surface and is spilling over for so many of us, where it's even though it's harder, people are taking this path, this healing journey, and it's brave, commendable work. You know, there's from the research, or in psychedelic studies, we'll measure how strong the mystical experience is. And also, one thing I like to measure that comes out of some psychedelic researchers in the UK at Imperial College is called the emotional breakthrough inventory. So a measure of how hard was that for you? Did you face something like the dark night of the soul and make it through the other side? And in the psilocybin studies, and we've seen it in ayahuasca, in ketamine work, if you have a complete mystical experience or a high score on that, and you went through something difficult, maybe through the other side, that's where the lasting transformation is. You know, not that it always has to be hard, but you know, the deeper you go, the more transformative it can be.
I'm trying to wrap my brain around how you would even measure an experience. Having had many psychedelic experiences, I come out the other side like, I don't even know what happened. Just
yeah, and that's part of the scale, to be honest, is that ineffable quality of, you know, you can't describe it, you can't put words around some of these things. But on the emotional breakthrough inventory, it just asks like five, six simple questions. Have I faced emotionally difficult things that I usually push aside, or I experienced a resolution of a personal conflict or a trauma, right? I was able to move towards challenging emotions rather than recoil away from them. And, you know, that's what these psychedelic medicines do, whether it's, you know, a psilocybin journey that's kind of profound and fascinating and opens up a whole new world to you, or an empathogenic MDMA experience that puts a warmth, a big safety blanket around revisiting past traumas. It's, you know, it really helps you go through it for that healing work.
Peter, you've talked about this before, but I'm loving this part of the conversation about, you know, Peter, the thing that you say that I've heard you say a couple of times is take pill, get better, you know, but in a lot of so when I regularly was on an SSRI, it was kind of like meet the old boss, same as the new boss, where it was like, I was trading one malady for another one, which was, you know, I'm no longer, you know, in some of these like depressed waves, and I'm not, you know, into suicide ideation, but I'm also not able to get real excited about anything going on in my life. I found that I was having a tough time, you know, getting the energy to do the things that used to really light me up and make me want to, you know, actively participate in life. And I mean, this podcast is called Mormons on Mushrooms, so obviously I'm going to, you know, praise psilocybin and these other entheogens, but that's really the thing, right? Is we're treating a symptom and we're trading it for other symptoms. And it's just about ranking which symptoms am I okay to deal with, you know, whether it be the side effects of the medicine or whatever. And I don't know. I don't think I have a point by saying all this. I just really liked what you were saying about measuring that. So I guess here's a question about what you're seeing with patients that you're having these experiences with, or participants. Maybe we'll call it participants. What do we call them?
Yeah, participants. I just use the word clients.
Clients. Okay.
Instead of patients and clients, or participants instead of research subjects.
So you're measuring mystic experiences, you're having your own experiences. At the beginning of the conversation, we kind of talked about your transition out of Mormonism and kind of what that looked like. Where are you right now? I know you don't want to put labels on this and it's just enjoy life and experience life, but you're still a clinician. I mean, you're still like, what's going on with these mystical experiences? What are these entities? What's happening?
Yeah, that you're touching on what I mentioned. I got out of some of my first ayahuasca experiences of like, these questions don't even need answers. The truth of who you are, your worth, it doesn't need an answer. It doesn't need someone approval, or even to tell you or to make sense. And, you know, like I said, there's a risk of getting too attached to that search for the meaning of life. And so where it's taken me is back to trying to embrace this aliveness, or the experience of being alive as, you know, a human on this journey with all these other humans on a journey. And that idea from, well, some of the great thinkers, Ram Dass and friends of that, we're all just walking each other home. And, you know, and it's led me back to this place of just embracing the culture, forgiving myself, forgiving everyone else, and seeing how we're all in this hot mess together. And I do believe that forgiveness is a key part of the healing journey. And letting go of the narrative and setting yourself and everyone else free So you can really go into these places of like compassion and connection.
I really like that. I remember, I think you mentioned this before. I remember being in a place in my own journey, like 20 plus years on SSRIs off and on, and really growing up in an environment where the church culture, by very well-meaning people, did a bit of a number on me, but raised in this space where knowing who you are, knowing where you came from, knowing why you're here, where you're going, was really, really stressed as being really, really important. And coming into a place of saying, I don't know the answer to that, and being okay with that, was some kind of watershed moment. And I'm very curious for you, kind of in your own journey away from likely a similar experience, but also being a clinician and a researcher geared towards finding stuff out, what is I don't know mean for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a really good question. You know what helped me in that path was absolutely crucial on my journey was a yoga and meditation practice. There are a lot of paths up this mountain. And when I moved from Salt Lake down to Utah County, for whatever reason, I was just kind of going with the flow. And I stumbled upon this yoga studio. It was at the same time of a lot of kind of faith crisis. And I went pretty deep on this practice of kind of yoga and meditation, the body as a vehicle to enlightenment and a resource for accessing kind of those reserves of stillness and for, you know, listening to the wisdom of emotions and all those things. But what happened for me in that practice, which it's one of the practices I'll recommend people consider while doing integration work. What happened is what they describe in yoga as the seeker becomes the seer. Like, you know, you realize that there's not a destination, there's a path and we're all on it. And, you know, life is in the here and now, not in the worrying about yesterday or tomorrow. And just, you can take yourself out of that monkey mind, slip back into that loving awareness place, and just like, you know, smile at the question instead of freaking out at it.
I just love how balanced you are. Like, having,
I know, it's fucking with me. I got to tell you,
it's like neuroscience and neurodevelopmental genetics, and then you're talking about the spiritual side of things. Like, I don't think I've met a more balanced human being between science and spiritual. And I just think it's really cool. I just had to point that out.
Same. Well, thank you. That's the greatest compliment ever. Cause I do see that as a big part of what I'm working on, is trying to bring those two things together, that science and spirituality, because I don't see them as different. I just, you know, the mysticism, the spirituality, the science, it's, you know, it's all kind of one and the same, and whether we can describe it or not.
A lot of the work around spirituality that you're describing, It touches on a sense of like a redefined sense of self or a sense of identity that might be different from maybe messaging that someone got when they were growing up. A lot, you mentioned that you had done a lot of work with eating disorders, which is also tied to self-image, body image, sense of self. How has eating disorder work specifically been impacted by a lot of this kind of treatment?
That eating disorders are a good example for a couple reasons of how psychedelic medicine might help or is helping. Because, you know, in eating disorders, and even long before that, disordered eating behavior patterns, or we all have work to do on our relationship with food and body. Like I believe that your relationship with food, is essentially your relationship with everything. Your relationship with body is your relationship with life in many ways. Like, you're going to rush through a meal, or say restrict what you eat or set all these rules around it, you're going to set all these rules around other things in your life.
Wow.
And so psychedelics kind of can wake us up to this trance we're in of unworthiness and like show you your supreme self, your innate goodness and power and worthiness. And even if it's just a glimpse for a moment in time, you've got that glimpse in this like experiential embodied way. So that's what I've seen in psychedelic medicine, whether it's with ayahuasca in far off lands or with ketamine here or with psilocybin MDMA in studies, is bringing, kind of opening that door to self-love, even briefly, so we can, you know, work like mad to bring that into day-to-day life.
When I think of eating disorders, I think of typically anorexia, not eating, or bulimia, eating and purging. Would you bring sort of the other side of that continuum in, like overeating and the obesity epidemic, and class that as an eating disorder as well for the purpose of the research?
Yeah. You know, in fact, we're doing it. The newest addition to the eating disorder diagnoses in our little diagnostic manual, the DSM-5, like it's on the one hand, kind of silly that we try to categorize all this, but it's also quite useful in research studies and trying to understand it, even though I'll be the first to admit that these mental health labels are an imperfect science for sure. But the newest diagnosis is binge eating disorder, which is actually the most common eating disorder. And with MAPS, we've been working on this protocol. It started out as anorexia only using MDMA, but then it was at Rick Doblin's request actually to add binge eating disorder in there, which is, like you said, completely on the other end of the spectrum. But I love that it is, because like psychedelics do help whether you have an over control condition like OCD, anorexia, anxiety, like where you have all these kind of worries and rules and restrictions to kind of protect yourself. Maybe you were hurt in the past and had to put up these walls. Or maybe it's, you know, genetics, environment, it's usually both. On the other end of the spectrum, you have some loss of control or kind of chaos where it might be spiraling in an addictive pattern. Like in binge eating disorder, you several times a week or more end up in this cycle of overeating. But one of the hallmarks is loss of control during, and then guilt and shame after. And so whether it's you can't get out of bed from depression, or you can't stop drinking, you can't stop binging, purging, whatever it may be, that's another area where we can strive for more balance, like swing the pendulum back through psychedelic medicine and therapy, especially therapy in this window of neuroplasticity that psychedelics open, where you can do some deep work and make it stick.
Is that work? I'm a real nerd about psychopharmacology and psychiatry personally. So here's a roundabout question. There's a fine gentleman by the name of Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote a book called The Body Keeps the Score, which has been transformative for me in my own understanding of trauma and shame and why I coped the way I coped for as many years as I did. I think there's an almost apocryphal quote attributed to him that it says essentially, if trauma was better understood, the DSM would be a pamphlet. In your work in navigating, you know, approval for research grants and trying to get treatment for specific conditions that are listed in the DSM, how often do you find that the root of these things, no matter what label you put on them, is based in trauma?
Yeah, it's huge. And, you know, Bessel van der Kolk has done some incredible things for our understanding of that. Just like, say, Peter Levine has in his somatic experiencing. And Bessel van der Kolk is actually one of the MDMA study principal investigators in the Boston area and is very immersed in this work. But with eating disorders, it you know, depending on the study you look at, it could be, I don't know, 30 to 90% have a traumatic kind of root. And, but I'm of the belief that, we all have trauma, big T, little T, lots of them. And it's not what happened necessarily. It's how it was held, like whether or not we had an empathetic witness to help us shoulder that at the time. It's whether or not we had these shared resources in us or around us to be able to process that, or if we had to squash it and put up walls. And so that's the first part of the healing journey is healing from trauma, and then letting go of that narrative, you know, like we were talking about with the forgiveness. Every trauma, there's a narrative of self-blame. It might be irrational, but it was usually highly protective. And so we've got to, you know, forgive ourselves and let that go, and then keep peeling away the layers, the conditioning, the deeply ingrained patterns and beliefs in other areas to really find that true liberation, or set ourselves free from the guilt, the shame, the fear, the all those other things holding us back.
Oh man.
I have a question.
That was a lot. Yeah. Sorry. I was being quiet because that was just a lot. Again, thank you for that. That spoke to me a lot.
I'm curious, have you tried all the different medicines that you administer in your practice? And if you have tried all of them, which is your favorite?
It's a good question. So yes, I've experienced, I am of the belief that you should have some experience with the medicines you work deeply with. And thankfully with ketamine, I was able to do that in a very legal, above board way from a medical provider. In the other medicines, I've had to get creative. And I do keep my own kind of personal, very firm boundaries around these things, because I work with them in this above board way. But on along the way in my personal kind of journeys and explorations, there was one that was, besides ayahuasca, that was very pivotal to me as well. And that was LSD. And, you know, I had traveled to a conference, you know, and it's a far off place with a psychiatrist friend, mentor, and who went with me on my first LSD journey. And it's interesting because after this wild, weird, wonderful adventure where I could, like, you know, see everything from a new perspective, see, like similar to ayahuasca, see people's souls by looking in their eyes, and, you know, time and space just kind of meant so much less, and you could start to connect the dots of your life. And then I, you know, stay up late, eventually convinces me, okay, like calling it a night and get a little bit of sleep, wake up, and I'm going to go into this conference. We were embarking on a new chapter in my career. I was going to start this new kind of subspecialty in practice. And I go to the registration booth. I already paid for the conference. We're out there. Put on my badge. I go to walk in, and it was like there was a force field. I could not enter the room, the conference. No way. Like I couldn't go in. I take this badge and just throw it in the garbage and go find a cafe to sit down at. And my friend comes and sits with me, and we just talk and cry and shed all the meaningful stuff from life, including that direction I was going down for whatever reason that this medicine helps steer me, you know, back onto my path.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Just probably a good time to remind our listeners that we are Mormons, and Mormons are inherently storytellers, and this is a storytelling podcast. Mm-hmm. Every story you hear is metaphorical, and it's a story. The conference took place on the moon of Endor. I think probably that's as good a place as any for that conference to have taken place. Right, good setting, real foresty, kind of cool.
It's true, and you know, we have had to go to great lengths to access these medicines in the right way, because of the unfortunate overscheduling and regulations and fear and everything. But I'm so grateful and hopeful that they're coming back in this way, and that it's society bringing it back. It's like all of us, I've never seen anything like it. People embracing mental health, embracing psychedelics, and decriminalizing, legalizing, and supporting the research. It's a train that can't be stopped. It's moving. It's coming. It's already here in many ways.
Gosh, I love hearing that. So I guess that's a good point, because I think that there's a lot of folks who would listen to this and wonder, well, what can they do? What kind of things can a person who's just sitting in their car listening to this episode right now, like what kind of things can everyday people do to help realize this hope for the future that you talked about, help push this along?
Yeah. And you mean do for the cause, to help this progress unfold, not necessarily looking at the personal work we can do.
Yeah, right. To help the cause itself, other than, right, fuck Ronald Reagan on their car window, what else can they do?
You know, if you look at back in the 60s and, you know, look at Timothy Leary's approach, let's say, you know, we can learn a lot from that. And God bless all their souls for, you know, what they did to bring this about. But there is a prudent way to navigate it, and not such a contentious one, right? Like, we're all humans in this hot mess together, right? And we're all seeking kind of peace, love, and bliss and connection. And so what we can do is kind of, one, keep that background and undercurrent of love in the equation, and, you know, and remember our shared humanity through it. But then in that spirit, I'm a big fan of coming out of the psychedelic closet, or talking to your psychonaut next door. I'm a big fan of what you all are doing to open up the conversation, to facilitate the conversation, create that safe space so people can share their healing stories with each other and help point us to these modalities that can be so transformative. And I'm seeing it happen all over the place. And Utah is embracing this in amazing ways.
Man.
If you had to guess, how long do you think it would be before everything is legalized and fully embraced and people can just go in and get therapy with psilocybin or whatever?
So before everything is fully embraced, that's a long ways away. But MDMA, so my predictions, MDMA is coming first. You know, might be approved if we're lucky before next year is over.
Wow.
But within the next 1 to 2 years. And psilocybin's coming next. It's coming down the pipeline. MDMA is in the latter part of phase 3 studies, which is the last type of study you do before FDA approval. It's on the fast track, official fast track designation. Psilocybin, there are two organizations kind of bringing this forward. Compass as a for-profit, publicly traded company, and USONA as a nonprofit. And they're both in phase 2. And so it's a little bit further behind than MDMA. But so that's how I think it will unfold. But there's a lot more coming down the pipeline, including MDMA and psilocybin for other conditions, but also things like know, there are IV DMT studies coming.
Holy shit.
Wow. There's Ibogaine and its power to help people heal from addiction, especially opiate use. Yeah, the future is bright for psychedelic medicine, but it will take some time.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Reed, we're kind of running out of time here, but you mentioned some of the things that you do in your personal practice, things like yoga, breath work, that type of thing. As Shalice mentioned earlier, you're just about the most balanced person I've ever come across. So can you give some advice or some tips on the practices that have helped you with, I guess just helped you with finding that this balanced, centered human person that also understands everything on the scientific side of it?
Well, you were all too kind. And, you know, I'm the first to admit that there's no perfect balance, and I'm always swinging on that pendulum or circling around it somewhere. But yeah, I'm a big fan of embracing some kind of contemplative spiritual practice, embracing doing something that engages with the body. There's so much to be gained there by, you know, kind of joyful expression and movement, arts and things like that. And then also plugging into something that lights you up, like whatever it is, some artistic pursuit, or it could be reading a book, painting a painting, or, you know, climbing a mountain. But we were talking about eating disorders earlier, and you know, I think we all need to make that shift from kind of the body as a billboard or some object to the body as our home. And, you know, from worrying about weight to just like health, and from moving to punish ourselves, like to work off a In-N-Out burger, to moving for pleasure and eating for fun and fuel. And so that's a big bias, I think, that we need to work on. And there's this a couple approaches I really like, a stance called Health at Any Size that has great principles around these, life-enhancing movement, eating for well-being. But then also intuitive eating is another one where, you know, it's a beautiful framework for working on our relationship with food. And you know, what's interesting is how intuitive eating, like intuitive living, like living your truth in, say, a faith crisis, intuitive eating encourages us to question the rules and listen instead to what our body needs. And similar to how, you know, we're all realizing we need to tune into our deepest, truest self and, you know, listen to, you know, our own intuition rather than just kind of believing what we're spoon fed.
I love that. That's great advice. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I usually at this point we would say, how do people support you? How do they track you down? What do you want us to say in this part? We got show notes where we can link anything. How can people support you and what you're doing?
All right. I'll give you three websites just for fun. Novamind.ca is my home base where we're doing the clinical work, the research. You can find me at reedrobison.com, and the nonprofit coming soon I mentioned, psychedelicinstitute.org.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Well, again, thank you so much for taking a couple hours with us tonight. That's generous, and it's just been fantastic. And gosh, this is, I'm lit up right now. Like, this has been really, really great. Thank you.
Likewise. It's been so touching to chat with all of you. I really appreciate it.
And Peter, thank you for joining us today. This is, yeah, I was worried about not being here with my mic, and and you just stepped right in. So thank you, Peter.
This is fun.
That's fun. All right, y'all. Okay. So expectation wise, this will come out. We release them every Tuesday. So it'll come out in 2 weeks. Is that right, Shalice? Or is it 3 weeks?
Oh, don't look at me. Ask Peter.
I think we have a couple in the can already. Yeah.
Okay. We'll make sure you're aware and
cool.
Yeah.
All good. Looking forward to it. I love what you're doing. So yeah, keep it up. And if you need any suggestions of who to chat with or anything like that, I'll be following along and let me know how I can help.
Great. We'll
yes, we accept. We need nothing but suggestions. That was yeah. Awesome. Cool. Thanks, right. Y'all. I love you. I love all three of you. Thank you so much.
Bye. Really appreciate it.
Yes. Yeah, have a good night. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to Mormons on Mushrooms podcast. We have so much fun recording it. And if you love it, we would absolutely love it if you could leave a review on wherever you get your podcasts. It would really help our visibility so more people can listen to it and be enlightened and hear our crazy stories. So thanks again for tuning in.